Good morning and welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. The family dinner experience has certainly changed over the years. In generations past, many families made a point of sitting down at the dinner table every night, rarely eating out or eating on the run. Then our kids got much more scheduled. Single parent or two income households had less time to prepare food. We got used to the idea of eating out more or takeout or fast food. But then another reversal. We're all as busy as ever, but the slow food movement reminds us of the importance of making that family dinner a priority. So many of us are falling back on old standby family recipes. Those family dinner favorites passed down from one generation to the next that today's moms, dads, and kids simply cannot live without. Later this hour, we will seek out some of your family dinner favorites and preview an upcoming WILL TV special featuring area family recipes. So think about that and be ready to share some examples of your family dinner table favorites a little later this hour. First, though, while there is always something you can do in your garden, in the dead of winter, let's face it, it is cold. The ground is hard. If there's snow and ice, heck, forget about it. Who's going outside to tinker in the garden? But Sandy Mason, horticulture educator with University of Illinois Extension, believes there are some important decisions you can make, some steps you can take for which there is perhaps no better time than right now. You can really kind of see the bones of your garden when there's no snow on the ground and there's nothing really growing. On today's show, we welcome back Sandy Mason to discuss landscape design and to take your questions, as always, on lawn and garden care. Sandy, welcome back to Focus.
Yes, good morning.
And a reminder, we do these shows from time to time to help with problems in the home landscape. We can take a wide range of questions on anything from trees and shrubs to vegetables and flowers, even houseplants. Whether you're trying to solve a problem or you're looking for suggestions on what to plant, your call's welcome this morning at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And as always, we welcome your questions on WILL's Facebook page. You can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is Will Public Media. Before we get to the idea of landscape design, you and I were talking off air, and it turns out that we were in nearly the same location between Christmas and New Year's in South Florida, around the Naples, Bonita Springs, Bonita Beach area. And you said you were doing some landscaping while you were there.
Yeah, you know, gardener, not only do you go to the beach, but we like to go and actually go somewhere else and garden.
Yeah.
What a vacation, huh?
Right. How different is the experience there to here?
You know, it really is one of those things that you when you do get into those kind of very different areas, you realize it really is different when it comes to gardening. And probably the biggest thing I noticed when I started gardening down there was just the fact that the soil is so different. It's, you know, sand. And we were just talking about, you know, if they have a torrential downpour down there, you know. Number one, it doesn't last very long.
No, it's they have
it's not all day. Usually.
They schedule it's a daily downpour. It's around 4:16 p.m. and it's over at 4:17. And they're very regimented about that.
Unless there's a hurricane.
That's
and then,
right.
Then it's
then all
a
bets
different.
Are off.
So, but it's one of those things that, but then as soon as it rains, you can like garden almost immediately after because of all that sand. And it just shows you how well sand drains. It drains all that water away. And that's good news, bad news. Gardeners can get into the soil and you can garden faster. But also all that water goes somewhere. And so those plants don't have that ready moisture that they typically would have up here. So it ends up being one of those things where you really think a lot about, you know, adding organic matter, trying to make sure that the plants actually are either, you know, used to that kind of drainage or trying to do the, you know, other things with soil, adding organic matter, those kinds of things to try to, you know, build up something so that the moisture is retained. So it is very different way to garden.
And it's also, I mean, it's obviously different plants.
Yeah.
And you have different animals to worry about down there,
right,
too.
Right. And the plants bite back. That's why I decided about every single plant that I was pruning down there. It seemed like they all had thorns, but that would be quite typical, or prickles or something, but that'd be quite typical of that kind of semi-tropical areas that is. That for those kind of plants, they needed something that sort of keep plants or animals from browsing on them the whole time. So typically they would be ones that would have a little prickle. So I wasn't really enjoying that part of it. Also, the other thing was, and I've gardened down there for a number of years, but I didn't realize they have little pygmy rattlesnakes that sometimes hang out in shrubs.
Mm-hmm.
So now I have this newfound respect for, you know, checking the shrubs before I do anything, just to make sure there isn't some little rattlesnake in there sort of hanging
alligators.
Out. Or alligators. So, Yeah, it's a little tougher down there, isn't it? You know, fire. You got fire ants. You have to watch where you're standing. So it was one of those things I enjoyed. Yeah, I enjoyed being down there. But it was like, oh, I can't wait to get back to the Midwest, where at least where I don't have to worry about everything biting back.
You can garden in peace.
Yes.
So let's bring it back to the Midwest and bring it back here to Illinois. As you mentioned, as I mentioned at the top of the show, this might be a good time to think about how you want to lay out your garden coming years.
Right. And it really is one of those things that where gardeners are often distracted by pretty things. And so, during the growing season, we're looking at the trees and the shrubs and everything that's blooming. And so sometimes we don't really think about the overall layout. So this really is a good time, this kind of downtime, to really look at your garden. And I think actually, even if we do get a little snow cover sometimes, it's really good because then it's like a blank slate. You can really sort of think about, does it really make sense that this is where the path goes. Do I really need something taller over here? It is almost like a whiteboard when you get snow out there. It kind of covers everything up, and you can start thinking through things. Because I think a lot of times when we have problems or issues or maintenance issues, it's often sort of things that we've created. Either the plants, we picked the wrong plant and they've gotten too big, or they need to be pruned, or we put the path isn't wide enough or isn't in the right spot.
Maybe you planted something that's a little more invasive and it's,
absolutely,
and it's moved into territory that it wasn't intended
to. Right. Yeah. So it's kind of nice this time of year. And plus, just to sort of think through, how many months we have here where there isn't a whole lot going on necessarily when it comes to color, thinking about things, whether it's adding evergreens. There's lots of new evergreens these days. They're, small conifers and stuff that actually don't get all that big. You just really have to read the labels, but make sure they're not going to get too big for the area you're going to put them in. So there's a lot of those things. So you really have some other colors besides just kind of brown and gray like we often have this time of year. So don't be afraid of adding evergreens. Just really pay attention to how big they're going to get.
It seems like we kind of fall back on a couple of basic philosophies. One is what looks prettiest, wherever we're putting it. And the other one is how does weather, specifically sunlight and rain, affect what I'm planting? Are there other factors we should be thinking about?
Yeah, I think probably, those are certainly really important ones. I think the other one would be that whole size thing. We don't often think about it. And what I usually tell people, because just goes back between the soil between Florida and here, is just the fact that we have such good growing conditions and generally enough moisture, good organic matter, those kind of things. Pretty much all the plants that we're going to have here are going to grow on the high end of their range. So if it says it gets 4 to 6 feet, plan on that 6 foot. I mean, they pretty much around here, that's how big they're going to get. So really look at the labels, do a little homework, and I think that helps us a lot. It's one of those things we don't often think about, but it really is something that really can create some maintenance issues if we don't pay attention to it.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and my guest is Sandy Mason, horticulture educator with the University of Illinois Extension. We're taking your questions on lawn and garden care, as we do from time to time, to help with problems in the home landscape and also to field any queries you have about trees and shrubs, vegetables and flowers, even houseplants. To speak with Sandy Mason, you can call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL. 800-222-WILL, or email your question or comment to will-talk@illinois.edu. We'll begin this morning with Patricia in Champaign. Hi, Patricia. Welcome to Focus.
Good morning. Thanks so much for doing this. And,
sure.
And thank you to Sandy as well. And my question really isn't so much about the bare bones of the garden as how I can think about a couple of perennial plants that I would really like to have in a good-sized pot. But I've discovered some of them don't winter over particularly well, and I thought maybe Sandy would have had some experience. I'm looking at one of the newer to me, either Black Magic or Black Lace. It's a Sambuca, but I don't want to spend a lot of time and effort getting it into a good-sized pot, only to discover it can't tolerate the wintering over. And I'm looking at the Bloomerang Lilac as well with the same sort of question. So maybe she can give us some hints about which perennials might winter over most successfully, knowing we get a lot of wind here.
Yeah, and actually, I don't know how big the pots are. But for outdoor pots, especially winter pots, bigger is better.
Okay, so bigger and maybe You know, once they get really big, they're awfully heavy, too.
Right, right. And so that is one of the problems that you end up having. But the problem really with having either perennials or shrubs or whatever that are out there over the wintertime is the fact that, especially with small pots, whenever that sort of freezes and thaws, it really damages the roots. And so it's usually more of a root issue than it is really the top part, to be honest with it, that usually kills them off over the wintertime. So that's why the bigger the pot, the better. Then hopefully it's not doing quite those big fluctuations that we might get between freezing and thawing. And then if you can, I realize maybe you're trying to make this as a decorative container through the wintertime. So you may not want to go ahead and cover it up, but anything that you could do, even if you just piled mulch a little bit around the pot, are you trying to make it more of like a decorative thing for the wintertime?
Not so much the winter, but I would be thrilled if it could make it through. And what you're describing may be why I had so much trouble keeping delphiniums going a long time. Freeze-thaw.
Yeah, it really is. That's really what's going to hurt them in the wintertime. So the bigger the pot, the better. Obviously, it needs to be one that can take that, because some of the ceramic pots, of course, are going
right.
to break apart. So obviously, you need to have something that's going to do well with those. But I would think, you know, even things like the Sambucus, the elderberry is actually more of a shrub. The lilac you mentioned was a shrub. And actually, a lot of times the shrubs do fine in those containers. I wouldn't go probably anything smaller than maybe like a 10-gallon, or I mean, they really need to be big pots.
Okay.
So maybe you're trying a little bit smaller pot.
So you would think maybe 10-gallon or larger.
Yeah, the bigger the pot, again, the bigger the pot, the better. If you don't have a really large pot, then either piling mulch around it, again, sort of trying to protect the pot so it doesn't go through those cycles of freezing and thawing.
So just some sort of insulation around
it
that would protect it.
Right, so it can be more of a gradual. It's that rapid fluctuations that really tend to kill them off when they're in pots like that.
Okay, thank you so much.
Yeah,
really
good luck.
Appreciate it.
Uh-huh.
Thanks for the call.
Bye-bye.
Mm-hmm. Is there a danger in over-mulching?
Sure. I mean, you can over-mulch things. And it, usually when you talk about over-mulching, it's probably more of an, you know, you really don't, except maybe in the wintertime, you can kind of sort of get away with that with perennials. But if you're actually putting them right next to the stems or and on trees, you never want to mulch right next to the trunk itself, it shouldn't look like a volcano. I mean, you know, and you see that sometimes you go along these volcanoes, because the bark is really different tissue and it needs to be out in the open. And the roots are different tissue, so they what needs to be covered. And so you really have to sort of think through that and don't over mulch things. Typically, we would probably think in the wintertime, again, you can sort of get away with it a little bit more. But through the growing season, we're probably talking about more like that 3 to 4 inches at the most, because you really don't want really thick mulch.
Do you think people tend to be overprotective or underprotective of their plants and trees and whatever is growing in their garden? Which way do we tend to veer?
Well, I think for a lot of times I have seen people sort of kill things off just through they care too much, almost, because they maybe overwater or they overmulch or so there is that.
If you plant something that was meant to grow where it is located. At a certain point, I mean, certainly you want to pay attention to it and make sure that if, you know, you're in a particularly dry season that you give it some water. But don't you kind of want to let nature to take its course?
There is that point. You're absolutely right. But until they're established, there is that establishment phase. And I think that sometimes I see what the mistake people sometimes make is that they get drought-tolerant plants. They think they have drought, and they buy them in the drought-tolerant plants. But they're really not drought-tolerant until they're established. So this idea that you can put out a drought-tolerant plant and then, like, never water it again really isn't the case. So you really do have to take care of them. Certainly perennials, that first year they're established. Trees, we're probably talking even 3 to 5 years before we would really consider them established. If they're still a young tree, like we're going to find out here this next year, you know, young trees from that went through the drought from last year, or even older trees that went through the drought from last year, they're going to suffer. You know, they got root dieback, those kind of things that would have happened because of that drought. But certainly those younger, less than 5-year-old kind of trees, shrubs are going to have issues if they weren't watered last year. So that is kind of a big thing, or that is a big thing. And let's hope that, that things did better than we thought last year, and that they have some tenacity to hang on.
I guess we just you sort of have to wait and see.
It'll be a lot, because it really is one of those things. I think what people will find is if they had a tree or shrub that maybe was not looking all that great and was really struggling for whatever reason, and it went through the drought last year, it might have been, you know, kind of the last straw. That's it. Also, when trees are under stress, shrubs are under stress, it certainly can make them more susceptible to other, you know, they're like us, other insect disease issues might come in because they're already under stress because of the drought. So then they get borers or something like that. So that we're going to see those kinds of things, that because they're not doing as well, not as vigorous, they get other things that start happening to them.
Do you recommend that people wait and see when it comes to something like that, or you know, whatever's left, dig it up and then plant something new?
My feeling is always, you know, I'm one of those people that, you know, to the last straw, I want to make it's dead, make sure it's dead, before I really decide that it's dead. So I would wait and see, you know, wait, and especially on trees or anything like that, wait and see how well it leaves out. You might be surprised. And maybe it didn't look all that well last year. Maybe drop some leaves early, had early fall color. But then come springtime, those branches go ahead and leaf out, even though maybe they had lost a lot of leaves last year. Because sometimes plants will certainly do that under stress. I was amazed last year with some of my perennials that went ahead and came back. I had a lot of ferns and things. Mm-hmm. Because of the drought, they just died down completely. And I thought, well, that's the end of that. But then toward the end of the season, we got a little moisture, the cooler temperatures, I was amazed how many went ahead and put out new growth again. So it's one of those things you just never know. And even our lawns, if you know, you remember last year, you know, things looked pretty dead when it came to lawns. But then we, again, got a little moisture, cooled off a little bit. I was really surprised at how well some lawns really came back. I really assumed that they were goners.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're talking with Sandy Mason, horticulture educator with University of Illinois Extension. We are taking your questions on anything from trees and shrubs to vegetables and flowers or houseplants. Whether you're trying to solve a problem, looking for suggestions on something to plant, considering that idea of maybe taking this time in the dead of winter to reconsider landscaping and kind of how you've laid out your garden. Your call is welcome this morning at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Or as always, you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Next up is Nancy in Urbana. Nancy, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
What's your question?
Well, usually I never remember my questions until she's done. I'm out working in the garden. I think, oh, maybe I could ask Sandy Mason about this. Maybe I could ask about that. Today, the brain and the program are
in sync.
In sync, yes.
Fantastic.
Yes. So I actually have two questions. We have a west-facing house with a, you know, it's being grand to call it a porch, but sort of a little concrete out in front of it, and then a place to plant things. We'd had Miss Kim lilacs, and Miss Kim was just a little too exuberant, so we couldn't get across through the sidewalk without a machete.
Yeah, yeah.
So
yeah.
We took out Miss Kim, and we put in grasses, and it's just not quite sunny enough for grass.
Hmm.
Grass is, it looks good, but it leans out. Again, it's the sort of machete thing where we're having to tie it back. And so I'm wondering now about holly.
So how big, describe the space again. So this is the space between the house and the sidewalk?
And the sidewalk, yeah. It's about
and
it,
how big foot, is it?
It's a little space. It's about a 3-foot space.
Oh, see, that's the problem.
Right.
Yeah, 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 as you've figured out. Because most plants are just are going to get bigger than that.
Right, right.
Yeah, yeah, so that's a big challenge. So is this an area where you really want to kind of soften the wall a little bit, or is it just you want to put something in that space? In other words, do you need something that's tall there, or do you
No,
really...
I don't need something that's okay. tall. I've got a view of about, oh, I don't know, half a mile out, so I like to watch. I like to look out onto the prairie and the corn.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I also like to have a little bit of wind protection because the wind does kind of rush through there in the winter from the west, and some place for the birds to land. So I don't want to just scalp it, and I didn't want something real low. Are there some small hollies? Because, I mean, A, would they grow in a semi-shady
Yes, they will grow in a semi-shady area. Okay. And I would, especially west side, I would think you'd get from, you know, sun all afternoon.
Yeah, it's hotter than crazy.
Yeah, you got to say it's really hot. So.
Right, but it's not enough for the grasses, to my surprise. I thought they would be happier there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure
mm-hmm.
I could grow that stupid sea oats.
Yeah, that would take over the whole area without
right.
any problem.
Yes.
Without any problem. Without any problem. Yeah, I guess I would think a couple things. I think the problem with holly is they don't necessarily like that late afternoon sun, to be honest with you. They're much happier with the easterly exposure where they're going to get that morning sun. Mm-hmm. They love that. And then kind of that cooler. They just don't like that hot stuff.
Okay.
So I'm not sure the holly's going to be all that terribly happy there.
All right. Well, yeah, there's no point putting in another shrub, especially a prickly one that's got to come out.
Yeah, right, right. That would be my other thought, too, with being in so close. There are some nice, you know, I think you're really going to have to think through, you know, I don't think you want a shrub that's going to get any bigger than 3 feet tall.
Yes, I think that's right.
Yeah, I think that's it. Because usually 3x3, that's, you know, you don't want to think about anything. The nice thing is there are some new shrubs now, some new cultivars, because you and a whole bunch of other people don't want a big shrub. They really just want something to look good. So there actually is some new spireas. Which
yeah,
I think are really good.
I think I have Anthony Waterer.
Yeah, those are the big guys.
To the north on that same walk.
Yeah, those are the big guys. I'm thinking of the pink ones, which mm-hmm. tend to be smaller. I think there's one called Double Artist that I really like, and it's supposed to be in that 3x3 category.
Mm-hmm.
So you may find just going to the garden centers and just kind of start looking for those 3x3 plants
mm-hmm.
And shrubs and see if those do well for you. Because I would think most things, you know, I would think most of the shrubs are going to do fine in that area if they get all that late afternoon sun, except for some of the, you know, like broadleaf evergreens like hollies and rhododendrons and stuff like that are not going to be too happy.
Yeah, and it's too late there for them, I think, as well anyway.
Yeah, so that might be a real option for you, sort of looking through that. And I don't mean to tout one brand over another, but just to sort of let you know, Proven Winners is one of those that's really been looking long and hard at these smaller shrubs.
Oh, good. Yeah, I have had success with them.
Yeah, and one of their big things now are these small shrubs. So you might just go to their website and start looking through and see if some of those work well for you.
Yeah.
And I've been really impressed with some of those smaller shrubs that they have now. And even they have some nice small weigelas. I don't know if you know those.
Yeah, I can never pronounce it. But
yeah,
it is.
And they have some really nice small ones that have really pretty foliage as well as flowers. And that's mm-hmm. the thing that I think is kind of a fun thing to look at these days when it comes to shrubs and stuff. So kind of look more at that 3x3 and go from there.
Question two is, our son's mother-in-law she lives in Springfield. She has a hydrangea bush that has the most beautiful purple blossoms. Just knock your socks off.
Huh.
Now, could this have been something that she managed to nurse through a winter that came from the grocery store? I haven't seen a lot of super, super dark purple.
I would say, is she doing anything to the soil? I mean, is she adding things to the soil?
You know, what I know about her gardening, I would guess not.
Okay. Because there are, you know, those not all hydrangeas will do that, but the ones that are in that kind of pink and blue range,
mm-hmm.
Depending on what the soil acidity is.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you add stuff like aluminum sulfate and stuff, it actually will change the color. And I have seen some that kind of look that purple-ish because they're in between that kind of red and that kind of pink and blue, and they almost look purple. So I have seen a few of those. And is it a new one, do you think?
Yes. Yeah, they haven't lived in the house very long, and I believe she actually...
So there are some new ones now that are more, much more hardy when it comes to overwintering, because that was always the problem with those pink and blue ones. They bloom on old wood, and so you had to have the old wood, and so it was always hard. So they really have some new ones, because people got really tired of not having flowers on some of those.
Yeah, the shrub isn't all that good looking without
Right. Okay. So I would start looking through some of the, I'm not necessarily touting Proven Winners, but, you know, it's a good place to sort of get some info, but you might start looking at, they have a bunch of hydrangeas these days.
Great. I should have thought that a plant company would have a website since everybody else does.
Believe me, they have a website.
All right.
They have the most voluptuous pictures. You'll want every single plant.
Oh, it's a good thing I'm looking at in January.
Yeah, there you go.
That's perfect. Thank you so
much. Okay, good
luck.
Uh-huh.
All right, thanks, Nancy. This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and my guest today is Sandy Mason, horticulture educator with the University of Illinois Extension. We are fielding your questions about lawn and garden care and the home landscape, from trees and shrubs to vegetables and flowers to houseplants. Whether you're trying to solve a problem or looking for suggestions on what to do in the garden right now or looking ahead to what you'll do in the spring, your call is welcome. To join our conversation, call 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, or you can email your question to will-talk@illinois.edu. I'd like to get back to something you mentioned a few minutes ago. You were talking about the this idea of that there are certain types of plants that seem to grow better if they are facing the west, others if they're facing the east. Why is that?
It's really the heat. You know, if you think about it, that, you know, early in the morning, you know, the sun just come up, so it tends to be, even though it's full sun, at that time, it's a cooler heat. You know, just the temperature.
The ground is cold.
Everything's cooler. Yeah, everything's cooler. So for a lot of things, they like that. Even, you know, for even some of the shade plants, like that morning sun, they'll actually color up better. You know, for some of the perennials that we have, like coral bells and some of those that have really pretty foliage, they'll actually color better if they actually have some sun, even though they're really shade plants. But they don't like that late afternoon sun, that, and it's hotter. The plants are drier at that time. You'll see that with hydrangeas. They have a tendency to just sort of wilt if they're getting that late afternoon sun. So it is one of those things that not all sun's created equal. It kind of depends on what time of day they're getting it.
And I guess it's also fair to point out most people's homes don't face directly west or east or north or south. Your garden is facing in some sort of angle. So is it a question of trial and error, or do you look up and find a list and say, okay, these are the plants I can plant here, and these are the ones I can plant here?
Yeah. Usually, I mean, we have plenty of lists when it comes to, like, shade plants. And I think part of it is just kind of, it is trial and error, to be honest with you, because it is not just the light. It's how what the soil's like, those kind of things. Because if they're getting a lot of moisture, late afternoon sun's not a bad thing for some of these shade plants. If there's plenty of moisture there, they're happy. So there is some of that is really trial and error. But that's the fun part of gardening, you know. And we all kill, you know, I'm here to admit, we all kill a few plants once in a while by just not quite putting them in the right spot or not really understanding our garden very well.
We now have several folks waiting to talk with you, so let's see if we can knock out a few calls. We'll start with Carol in Downs. Hi, Carol.
Hi. I have a question about dodder. This is a plant I had absolutely no idea about, and I saw this strange yellow patch along a railroad track. And I went and looked at it, and as you know, it just looks like somebody took a sort of a gold-colored silly string. And then it has spread. And I just want to know about it. I mean, I looked it up on the internet, and there are about 1,000 different kinds. And it just seemed like maybe it showed up because it was such a mild winter last year.
I have actually, and if people aren't familiar with dodder, it is a parasitic plant, so it needs other plants to live off of. And it really is a pain if you get it because it's so, like you say, it's silly string, but it's like tough silly string.
Yeah.
It's hard to even walk through if you ever get it in natural areas. So it is a plant that's really tough. Now, I've noticed it a little bit more. I've never heard anybody say it's because it was a milder winter, so I'm not sure I can actually, you know, say one way or the other. But I'm with you. I seem to notice it a lot more than I ever had before. So there may have been something in there. The one thing is with dodder, there are some specific things. And one of the things that unfortunately sometimes people do is that if they mow it at the wrong time, you know, thinking they're getting rid of it, and they mow it the wrong time, it actually spreads it and makes it worse. And I'm afraid what may have happened in some of these areas, because these are, you know, maybe roadside areas or whatever, they happen to mow it at the wrong time and then suddenly it's like spread all over the place. I actually got it from a garden center plant one time. I had the sedum and it had this weird thing and I thought, what is this? So it just kind of pops up here, there, and everywhere. So.
Okay. My next question is, what can be done about it? The reason is that this is an area where we have a farmer's market. It's an abandoned railroad track. And I just think we need to do something with it. I mean, I've seen those pictures Shawnee National Park, where it's just, there's an acre of it or something. I mean, it's just frightening.
Well, it'd be one of those things. This is on railroad property, or?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think it's one of those things that if you want to contact the landowner, and then they can get under a program, as I said, it's real important on when it gets mowed. You know, mowing can help.
Well, see, the village mows it.
Okay.
The village downs mows that area.
Okay. So maybe just understanding a little bit more about the plant and knowing when to mow it.
That's not going to be, they mow on a schedule. It's not going to impress them.
Well, I'm just letting you know. You asked me what the management techniques would be, and one of them happens to be when it's mowed.
Okay.
And so if they're truly interested in finding out how to manage it, that would be one of the things.
Okay.
And there are some chemical treatments as well if they want to go that route. But, again, they need to get under a management program.
What kind of chemicals? I mean, it just seemed to me that what I read about it was that it had to find a host plant quick.
Well, that's why mowing and those kind of things,
right,
depending on when it gets mowed. And so
if you did Roundup all around it so that it couldn't find a host plant and you didn't mow, I understand what you're saying about mowing.
Right. So, but I think they really need to look at the situation because you don't necessarily want to round up everything either. So I think finding, they really need to do a little bit. There are things that can be done, but because this is railroad property, village is mowing it, there needs to be a management plan on how it should be managed.
Thanks very much for that call. Let's move on next to Dave in Champaign. Hi, Dave.
Yeah. With regard to perennial plants, it seems to me that you could encourage native prairie, which is sustainable and it doesn't have to be brought inside, and it encourages friends and neighbors to realize that they have a heritage, this prairie, and it's quite interesting.
Sure. I mean, native plants are great. I mean, there's a lot of different native plants. So I think just if people get more familiar with what types of native plants are there, and certainly, like Grand Prairie Friends, and there's some great groups that have plant sales. I think it's always in May, like the second weekend or something in May. Yeah. I think that maybe the Saturday before Mother's Day.
All right. That's it. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Kathy is in Sydney. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. I have an old pear tree that got some fire blight last spring, and unfortunately, I did not prune it. What can I expect from it this spring?
Well, what I would do is with fire blight seemed to be bad the last couple of years. At least that's what I've noticed. Is you need to get that. It's a bacteria, so you need to get it out of there. as far as pruning it, and I would, if you don't mind getting out when it's like this, it's fine. You really just want to prune that when it's dry. And then every time you make a cut, you need to make sure that you sterilize the tools in between each cut. Or it's a bacteria, so you're just going to spread it on your tools. If you don't use like a Lysol spray, some kind of disinfectant spray in between each cut. And then when you do cut, where it's dead, you want to go down at least 6 inches beyond where you see the damage. So you try to get beyond the bacteria. So you make a cut. So really, the best thing for fire blight is just good sanitation and pruning when it's dry, so you don't have to worry about any kind of moisture out there that might help to spread it. And that's going to be your best bet. And then get that stuff out of there. And then a lot of times, if it's not real bad, a lot of times you can take care of it that way. If you have huge, you'll get these cankers on them. If you have large cankers on major branches, it may be really tough to end up with any production, at least in the next couple of years. But if you have just a little bit of it, you can prune that out and be pretty successful.
Okay. I will see what I can do. Thank you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for the call. Is this a good time to think about pruning?
Absolutely. You can, part of it, this time of year ends up being our comfort, I think, as much as anything. But usually we probably think about, for a lot of the plants, we probably think more like in March or so when we've really gotten through the worst of the cold weather, or at least we hope we've gotten through the worst of the cold weather. So February and March is usually a pretty good time. So we usually try to wait till then, but if people want to get out there, they can do that.
I asked about this last time, but I figure it probably bears repeating. What are some of the most important things you can do to protect your lawn and garden through the winter months?
Yeah, I think probably some of the big, when you talk about protecting, I think if people haven't mulched things, if you haven't mulched strawberries or some things, you may want to do that. Lightweight mulch is always good. Shredded leaves, lightweight mulch, those kind of things is good. I think probably one of the big things is rabbits. Rabbits can do a lot of damage, especially especially on young shrubs. But they'll even attack raspberries. So I think just walking through your yard now is a good thing. And you can see what plants are starting to be attacked by rabbits. And you can go ahead and put chicken wire or something around them to help protect them. So that's one of the big things, because we do get a lot of that this time of year.
Sandy Mason is horticulture educator with University of Illinois Extension. Sandy, as always, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Up next, we will seek out some of your family dinner favorites and preview an upcoming WILL TV special featuring area family recipes. Lisa Braltz will join us to seek out your favorite family recipes. That's after a short break. This is Focus.
As one of the growing number of women who waited until her late 30s to have her first child, Judith Shulevitz wonders if babies have a higher risk of developmental disorders if they were conceived by older parents and fertility treatments were involved. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Shulevitz about her recent article in the New Republic examining the research. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and at 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Burlingame Home Inspection and Performance. Burlingame performs property inspections along with energy audits and ratings for Energy Star, tax credits, and efficiency mortgages, all utilizing infrared technology. More information is at cusaveenergy.com or 217-649-1173.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. The family dinner experience has really changed over the years. In generations past, many families made a point of sitting down at the dinner table every night, rarely eating out or eating on the run. Then our kids got much more scheduled. Single parent or two-income households had less time to prepare food. We got used to the idea of eating out more or takeout or fast food. And then there's sort of another reversal in recent years. We're all as busy as ever, but the slow food movement reminds us of the importance of making that family dinner a priority, of taking your time. So many of us are falling back on old standby family recipes, those family dinner favorites passed down from one generation to the next that today's moms, dads, and kids really cannot live without. Joining us now to talk about family dinner favorites is WILL's Lisa Braltz. In addition to serving as our marketing director and producing the occasional segment In My Backyard on WILL AM 580, Lisa is the former economic development specialist director at Urbana's Market at the Square, and she will soon host a special on family dinner favorites on WILL TV. Lisa, welcome to Focus.
My pleasure. It's good to be here.
And as we begin our conversation, we welcome your examples of family recipes you and your loved ones simply cannot live without. Those dinner time staples that you go back to again and again, those classic recipes. Maybe you've created them yourself. Maybe you've received them from past generations. Maybe they've been passed down, you know, one generation to the next, to the next. And maybe that recipe card is getting really thin and hard to read. Call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone number is again 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. And Lisa, as we get started, I want to bring Sandy Mason back in just for a minute, because Sandy, you were telling us off the air that you've got a family recipe that sort of falls into this kind of category.
Yes, absolutely. My grandmother always made this apple dumpling recipe. And my grandmother has since passed away, and I wanted this recipe because I had such fond memories. And I searched the web. Couldn't find that particular recipe. Everybody makes apple dumplings very different compared to what. This was a recipe that my grandmother would make, and at our family reunions, people would fight over it. People would eat, they would go to the dessert table first because they wanted to make sure they got apple dumplings. That was how important this thing was.
Have you tried to recreate it?
I did, and actually it was kind of fun in that I, talking with my dad and my aunt, we tried to recreate it just from what they remembered, and they kind of sort of had a recipe, but it was kind of like a pinch of this, a dab of that, a little water, those kind of things. So
add some salt.
That's not helpful.
Yeah,
really. But it was kind of fun, to tell you the truth, kind of going through this with my dad, because he had fond memories, obviously, of his mother, and kind of recreating this. And so we tried it a few times, and I think we did a pretty good job. But it was one of those things that I think we started thinking about my grandma. So it's that wonderful feeling of, you know, here's this item that's food and it's good, but it sure was nice sort of reminiscing about my grandma.
And it harkens back to a different era. And Lisa, and that's kind of part of what the TV show is, I imagine, going to be about.
Yeah. Yes, definitely. I mean, I think that's a big part of it. You know, we know that these days family can mean a lot of different things. So when we say family dinner favorites, it's really what is the food that you, that your tribe, whoever that, that tribe is, what do they insist on? Sort of like your family, Sandy. You know, and what's really interesting about your story is that your grandmother, the food that she made is still bringing your family together, mm-hmm. and that your relatives, your dad, your aunts, uncles, whatever, you're all trying to replicate that food. So we are, that is definitely a big part of what we're trying to do on the Family Dinner Favorites show. And we want to compile those Family Dinner Favorites, your recipes, the viewers and the listeners out there, into a cookbook so they can be shared with other families too.
I mentioned the slow food movement, but there have been other movements affecting the food that people choose to prepare at home these days. You know, more locally produced foods, more organic foods. How does that impact the kinds of recipes that you might anticipate seeing in the show?
Well, I think, you know, we've received many recipes already. So, you know, we've gotten recipes with, you know, maybe 6 ingredients, and we've gotten recipes that are much more elaborate to prepare. What I really think is happening is that there is an incrementally increasing interest in just in food and making food and going home and being with your family and having that be something that you do. Maybe not every night. As Craig said, we're all so busy. It's really hard to come together, I think, every night. I know there are families and groups of people who do that. But even just to be able to go back to these recipes that are maybe from your own childhood or that you've started making once you had your own family, to be able to return to that, that's really a touchstone. That's really important.
Or maybe that are so successful.
Yes,
that's
important.
Get the kids that are off doing activities or the adults in the household, everybody going in different directions, but everyone will converge on the dinner table because of certain recipes. I think
yes.
Every family's got one or two of those.
Absolutely they do. And converging on the dinner table like that and having that food item bring the family together then begets a lot of what else is important about eating together, that conversation and not talking just about food, but about your day and current events and whatever else that you know, your family or tribe or group likes to talk about. So, you know, this program, you know, the cookbook that comes with it, this is going to be happening on March 4th from 7 to 9 p.m. And it's a pledge special. So it's during our TV membership drive here at WILL. And the premium for the show, pledge premium, will be the cookbook that's compiled all of these recipes, all of your recipes out there, people listening and viewing. And the cookbook is called Come and Get It, Your Family Dinner Favorites. So this is really a book and a show that is coming from you and your families.
And to that end, if you have some examples that you would like to share with us right now, right here today, you can call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We'd love to hear what examples you have of maybe that one great recipe that really does seem to bring the family together at the dinner table when you really need them.
Exactly. And also, if people just want to email directly to where we're compiling the recipes, they can also email to willmembership@illinois.edu.
So if you'd like to participate in the program itself.
Exactly.
And so you'd send in the recipe and then you'll get together with them and work out a time to, I guess, for them to come and prepare.
Yes.
It, right?
If someone out there really wants to be the next Rachel Ray, who got her start on a local food, local cooking show. If somebody out there has a recipe that they want to submit and they're interested in cooking on the show, they should definitely mention that in their email or in their note or whatever that they send. Because
and that's, again, willmembership@illinois.edu.
Yes.
You mentioned that you already have some recipes. Mm-hmm. Can you share some examples of maybe classic family dinner table recipes our neighbors in Central Illinois
sure.
May be likely to share during the program?
Well, I have a few here that I pulled from our submissions today. Someone named John sent in a recipe called Mama Shorty's Buttermilk Pie. So this is a dessert recipe. And what I really love, too, in addition to just the list of ingredients and how to prepare it, is the little anecdotes that come along with it. So he says, now I know that buttermilk and pie don't sound like they would really go together, but trust me, it is really delicious. Mm-hmm. He talks a little more about it. We have the recipe. And then he ends with, this pie is so good, it'll make you slap your mama. Enjoy. So we've received that one. We got a little more.
I don't think I would do that.
No, well, it's a turn of phrase. But
all right.
Yeah. So we received another recipe from someone named Karen. This is probably more of a special occasion type dinner, grilled mussels with lime butter. But I'm looking at the recipe and it's, you know, there's fewer than 10 ingredients. So it's something that is completely doable. And then an 8-year-old viewer, listener, fan of WILL. YLL named Paige submitted Powerballs. A recipe for Powerballs. And this, you know.
Lottery tickets?
No, not lottery tickets. Okay. I think these are peanut butter, oats, flax seeds, ground nuts, raisins, rolled up into a ball. You eat them.
Yeah.
And again, this it's simple and tasty. And maybe it's not, maybe it's a dessert item. It's not something that you're digging into as a main course. Or maybe you are. I don't know. But these are just some of the examples. So really, it's not limited just to an entree. It can be a side, it can be an appetizer, it can be a dessert, just something that is really important to your family that, you know, people are always asking for.
I was trying to think of what in my family might be that one recipe.
Yes.
My grandmother had a recipe for stuffed meat and cabbage that my mom has then took over, if you will, and has passed on to the rest of us.
Are we going
to
get that?
Well, the problem is you need her to prepare it. I'm not very good at it.
Does she have it written down somewhere?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, we have it written down. Actually, it's in a family cookbook, so I might be able to pass that along to you. Well, I was curious if you had any recipes that you could think of that seemed to be within the Brault-Kelley oeuvre.
Well, when I was growing up, I grew up in a household where both my parents worked. My mom is an excellent cook, and so was my dad. But he didn't cook very often. So I have a family unfavorite from him, which was liver and onions. Like, any time that my mother was out of the house, my brother and I were just like, oh no, here it comes. He's an excellent cook, and so he could have done better. But my mother is also an excellent cook, and she really, even though, our dinners maybe during the week were not super elaborate or anything, she really splashed out over the holidays. And one tradition that she started with us on Christmas Eve was this spectacular lasagna that she made every Christmas Eve. And so that's something that I don't make it every Christmas Eve, but I have been known to trot it out during the holidays because I feel like, oh, it's winter, there's snow on the ground, or in some places there's snow on the ground, and it's close to Christmas, so I really feel like I need to make this. And another also holiday-related is this cinnamon roll recipe that I've sent out to many friends all over the world, and now my friends will send me pictures of these cinnamon rolls that they make. My mom would make them ahead of time, freeze them, and then just pop them in the oven when we were kids because we needed to eat something, but she didn't want to make breakfast. So maybe liver and onions is not going to make an appearance in our cookbook, not at least not from me, but I'll probably submit one or two recipes myself.
You'll also have some area chefs on the program.
Yes.
What can we expect from them?
Yes. And in the show, in addition to the four home cooks, we are bringing in two local chefs to actually showcase how they cook at home and a family dinner favorite of their own. So Thad Morrow from Bacro Restaurant will be joining us. He's on the schedule. These are scheduled but tentative. You know, mm-hmm. we're still 6 weeks out from the show. So he'll be coming in to demonstrate a family dinner favorite, something that he cooks a lot with his son, who is 4 years old. Mm-hmm. So it could be that they maybe bring in prepare something together on the show. And then we also have Elisa DeMarco, who is the chef at Prairie Fruits Farm. So she's responsible for those wonderful dinners on the farm that they do out there. And she also works with Hendrick House on cooking there here on campus. So they'll be our two chefs. And then we'll also have a local farmer. I'm hoping to have Hans and Katie Bishop from Prairie Earth Farm in Atlanta, Illinois, which is near Bloomington, to come in and talk about what's available and how local food is becoming more available seasonally year-round because of certain infrastructure, weather changes, et cetera. And then we'll have Todd Fusco from Corkscrew come in and talk about beverage pairing.
Excellent. We have Mike on the line from Urbana, and he has, I believe, a ravioli recipe to tell us about. Mike.
This is Frank.
Frank, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Frank.
Okay. Well, we've been doing raviolis with my mom and family for close to 50 years, and we used to do them for Christmas Day. We would get up early in the morning, but the last few years we'll do them a couple weeks beforehand and roll them out and freeze them. And we actually have a production line now where we've got the dough prepared and we've got the cheese, and then we'll have everything set up on the table, and we'll have people that will be rolling out the dough, and then someone will be spooning the dough, the cheese filling onto the dough, and then we'll have a glass cut it. We don't use any of those metal cutters. We'll use like a shot glass or a shrimp cocktail glass. We haven't found the right size glass that works just right. And then we have crimpers, and they'll crimp it with a fork and poke hole in it. And I actually have the recipe. I don't know if it would be too detailed to go into Do we have time for me to talk about the recipe?
If you could email that recipe to willmembership@illinois.edu. And
I can sure do that.
And the explanation that you just gave of your assembly line and how it's evolved over time, that would be great. That's exactly the kind of thing that we're looking to put in this cookbook.
And this was actually a recipe my grandmother did, and my mom and my aunt got together, and my grandmother was a cook-by-feel person, and she'd say a pinch of this and a handful of that.
Exactly.
Yeah. So she'd start doing that, and they'd stop her, and they'd measure everything, and they wrote it down. And then some years ago, one of my daughters actually transcribed the recipe. And the last few years, we've been able to include the next generation of people into making this. So it's been a lot of fun.
Excellent. Hey, Frank, this is a personal curiosity of mine because I'm from St. Louis. I want to ask, have you ever made toasted ravioli?
No. In fact, that's anathema. It's like toasted ravioli. Oh, my gosh.
It's one of those St. Louis things that if you're not from there, you just don't
find it. It's definitely not a south side of Chicago.
No, not at all. Okay, have you made Italian beef? I guess that's closer, right?
Okay.
Well, listen, please do send that recipe along.
I'll transcribe it right now as we're talking.
Wonderful.
Excellent.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for the call.
Okay, bye.
And we are, I'm afraid, out of time, but I do want to say thank you to Lisa Braltz for coming in and telling us a little bit about this upcoming special. It sounds like it'll be a lot of fun.
Absolutely. March 4th, 7 to 9.
And one more time, we'll mention that email address. If you have a recipe, a family dinner favorite that you think the rest of East Central Illinois would love to hear about, email it to willmembership, W-I-L-L membership, all one word, at illinois.edu. And we'll be in touch, and we'd love to include it in the cookbook.
And Sandy, whatever you can do to kind of put that recipe together, it would
apple
be absolutely
dumplings.
Perfect. Yeah, and you can talk about your grandma, too.
Okay, great.
Thanks again as well to Sandy Mason, horticulture educator for University of Illinois Extension. Sandy, Lisa, thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
On tomorrow's show, recently the Baseball Hall of Fame announced it would induct no new players this year. For the first time in more than a decade, that was the case. It's a move many view as a statement from the voting baseball writers against the use of steroids in professional sports. Meanwhile, today, cyclist Lance Armstrong is expected in some way to admit to using performance-enhancing drugs during an interview with Oprah Winfrey. On tomorrow's show, we will talk about the use of banned substances to gain a competitive edge and how professional athletes' use of the drugs can influence young athletes. We'll talk with Andrea Wickerham of Drug-Free Sport about the prevalence of steroid use in high school sports and what's being done about it. We'll talk with Don Hooten of the Taylor Hooten Foundation. His son got involved with steroids while he was in high school. They helped contribute to a number of behavioral problems, and Taylor ultimately took his own life. We'll hear his story, and we'll discuss the issue with Kurt Gibson of the Illinois High School Association as well. That's on tomorrow's program. Today's show was produced by Lindsay Moon. Kyle Mabry's our technical director. He handled your calls. I'm Craig Cohen.